From 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, welcome to The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you.
Hello and welcome to The Art of the Matter. I'm Travis DiNicola. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Baselli Wallrab Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
And I'm Sharon Gamble. Today I'll find out how the Indianapolis Symphonic Choir is getting to Carnegie Hall.
And then I'll find out about a new opera based on a Vonnegut work.
And I'll check in and learn about this year's Start With Art Luncheon, and we'll have that arts calendar we call
What'll We Do? All that and more right after the latest news from NPR. How do you get to Carnegie Hall? Practice, 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 of course. Well, Sharon Gamble invited Indianapolis Symphonic Choir Artistic Director Eric Stark to tell us why he's taking the ensemble to New York City's most storied venue this October.
So I want to talk about the season, 80th anniversary season. I hasten to add, you've only been there a tiny fraction of those 80 years.
I have not been there all 80 years, although some days I feel that way.
Remind me when you joined.
I'm beginning my 15th season with the choir.
Get out. Is that possible?
Yeah. It flies by, doesn't it?
It does indeed. And you have so much more to that I know you want to program. So
yeah, my list is not getting any shorter, it seems.
That's good. But I want to make sure we have plenty of time to talk about the Carnegie Hall performance on October 16th. And it's been a really long time since the Indianapolis Symphonic Choir has sung in Carnegie.
That's right. The last time we went, we were guests of the Indianapolis Symphony Orchestra and performed the Berlioz Requiem with Maestro John Nelson in Carnegie Hall. I don't believe there are any singers traveling with us this time who were there before, but there could be one or two. I'm trying to recall. It's been maybe 35 years or so.
That would be a long tenure.
We have some kind of close to that amount of time, and certainly we have fans who still come and who remember that trip quite fondly. The bus apparently broke down on the Pennsylvania Turnpike.
Oops.
As all tour buses do, I believe. But
it's
yeah,
part
we're
of the equation.
To,
it's
it
a
is,
bonding
It is.
Thing.
It really is. It brings the group closer together and elevates the music to a higher level.
Wait, what? You might have to explain the anatomy of how that works.
That'll be in the part two interview.
I see. Okay. Or, dear listeners, tickets are on sale now. I imagine if you go out, don't tackle Eric till after the concert, but he might tell you that. Insider
indeed.
Information.
Indeed.
Yeah. So why is it important? I mean, we all hear Carnegie Hall, and it's kind of like the mecca for musicians. But why is it important for you as an artist to be there?
Well, as the conductor of this wonderful choral organization, I'm proud always to get to share the work that they're doing with the widest possible audience. And so performing in an acknowledged kind of super venue like this in the fine arts world is an opportunity to do that, not just for the folks who will be there in the audience that night, but for the wider audience that might experience or hear of the work that we've done through the media that we hope will be there to cover. And of course, the experience is rich on just so many levels, as you and your listeners can imagine. It's a storied venue, just dripping with history.
Sure.
You get goosebumps even walking past it on the sidewalk, no less of walking out on the stage and getting ready to perform.
Do you feel extra pressure?
Yeah, a bit. There's a high expectation, certainly, and the audiences who come are the audiences who hear, you know, the New York Phil and the world's great performers, solo artists as well as ensembles, I believe we're ready for that, and I'm proud to put the choir on the stage. But at the same time, I don't want to have a bad moment in the middle of all of it and drop my stick on the floor or something like that.
You'll be getting a good night's sleep before, as will all the singers.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. We'll get out there. The concert, as you said, is on a Sunday, October the 16th at 2 in the afternoon or 2:30. I can't remember. We'll travel as a group on Friday morning. I think we're booked on 3 or 4 different flights, and we'll have some rehearsal Friday in the afternoon and Saturday during the day, and then a dress rehearsal Sunday morning in advance of the performance.
That's
Sunday
a lot
afternoon.
Of time to yeah. get used to the acoustics of the hall.
It is. However, well, it's a lot of time in rehearsal. We're only in the hall on the Sunday.
I see.
Yeah, so okay. The Saturday rehearsal and the Friday rehearsal will be off-site, and that's typically how it goes. Though I have conducted in Carnegie Hall previously one time and had choral rehearsals in the basement of a church and an orchestra rehearsal in a – it was an actual orchestra rehearsal space designed for that, but not much bigger than this studio that we're in for rehearsal of the Mozart Coronation Mass Orchestra. It was a little – intimate, as we might say.
The studio is a 10-by-10 room for listeners who are trying to picture it. You had to like one another.
But you're in New York City. You know the hotel rooms are going to be small. You know you're going to be cramped on the subway, and you know your rehearsal space is going to take some getting used to. But it's certainly worth the trade-offs for us. We're so proud of the arts community here in Indianapolis that has supported the choir now for 80 years.
Yeah.
Getting to take the choir out of our city and to such an acknowledged venue is a wonderful way to, I think, bring attention back to our community.
Absolutely. A technical question. So you frequently need to get both your ears as the conductor, the person who's leading, accustomed to new venues, and you need to get the singers mm-hmm. accustomed to how they're going to listen to one another.
Right.
Tell us some of the tricks of the trade. How do you do that?
Well, that's the perfect expression for this process, the tricks of the trade. And I think it is really crucial for the singers to have an aural, A-U-R-A-L, understanding of the space in which they're singing. And so I've ripped off a number of tricks. Actually, I don't do anything that's original. Everything in my toolkit I've stolen from some other conductor. So just with that disclaimer out there, one of the things, of course, in every vocal warm-up that I do with a choir, we do some tuning and we do a lot of soft singing that really requires the ears to be fully engaged as well as the brain. The vocal warm-up is as much about the brain and the ear as it is about the vocal mechanism itself. And so we're in the habit of doing that every time we rehearse and perform together. But in a new space, I'll add to that a couple of things to just, you know, we'll sing something kind of loud and high and give a very sharp cutoff that allows us to hear how long the room will ring, mm-hmm. which tells the singers a little bit about articulations that will be required in the performance if we make spaces that are bigger or if we need to make T's and D's and K's that are crisper.
Mm-hmm.
We also will do some soft, quiet singing, and that usually will involve, and I always get puzzled looks from the house staff if they observe this happening, but I'll have the choir over 16 counts stand in place but rotate slowly 360 degrees while they sing a sustained ooh mm-hmm. syllable or something, mm-hmm. just so that their ears can kind of map the sound reflection off of all of the surfaces that surround them. And those are the ways. And then we kind of dig into the music, but we'll make adjustments with dynamic and with tempo, certainly, based on what we hear. Some of those things we can anticipate before we get into the hall, but a lot of them we won't know until we get out there. And then once the audience shows up, all of that can change because, as you know, the acoustics of a room will change when it's filled with people,
absolutely.
Especially in the wintertime when they bring their heavy coats.
Right, right. Lots of soft absorptive
That's right.
services. Do you have some people with you who can function as ears out in the house and move around to different seats?
Yes. That's a crucial element to the equation, as you point out. And the number one person on that regard is Dr. Michael Davis, who's our Associate Artistic Director. He and I have been working together since before I came to the Symphonic Choir and have a wonderful working relationship and a way of communicating. So while I'm on stage warming up the choir or even rehearsing the piece, he'll be out in the auditorium and report back with issues that may need attention. And sometimes we'll swap places and I'll have him wiggle the stick a little bit while I go out and listen. And I just find that to be so crucial for all of us, but especially as the conductor, because in a lot of rooms, including some here in our fair city, the worst place to hear kind of the sum acoustic is the podium.
Sure.
And so we need to go out and hear what the audience hears so we know what we're doing.
Yeah, I never really thought of it in this way before, but as a conductor, you're essentially conducting the audience's experience as well.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it.
Yeah. So tell us about the Mimesis Ensemble mm-hmm. and about maybe not all of the repertoire. I want there to be some surprises.
Some surprise.
But, yeah.
Well, to talk about that ensemble, we'll also draw in the repertoire that we're performing. And we're very, very proud to be taking to New York the work by Mohammed Farouz, an American Arab-American composer who lives in New York, whom we commissioned to write an oratorio for us a couple of years ago. We premiered it here in Indianapolis in April of last year with the Indianapolis Symphony Orchestra at Circle Theater. And it's a piece that I'm just so proud of, not just the fact we commissioned a major work for chorus and orchestra and children's chorus, but that we did it with a lot of community involvement. For a period of over 2 years, we held choral roundtable conversations with invited directors from church and synagogue and school and community choirs to tell us, if somebody gave you a blank check and said, we'd like you to design a major work for chorus and orchestra that might last between 30 minutes and 45 minutes, never mind that it actually came in at an hour in length because our composer got inspired, what would you like it to say?
Yeah.
What values would you like to represent? What text might be important to you? What kind of instrumentation? It wasn't a given that it would be a symphony orchestra.
What a great process.
And so the input that we got was wonderful.
Yeah.
Use of some soloists. We have a baritone and tenor soloist. Use of children. So we have a children's chorus that sings. The Indianapolis Children's Chorus performed with us in the world premiere here. And they will travel with us to New York City. We're very proud to share the stage with them in that opportunity. And this group of constituents, for lack of a better term, also articulated certain themes of peace and understanding and commonality. And so gradually we gravitated towards the use of psalms, which are common to the three Abrahamic faiths. Although the psalms are not in the Quran, they're mentioned in the tradition and regarded as prophetic writings. And so we sing excerpts of a couple of psalms, including Psalm 2, which is the famous Why Do the Nations Rage, that is also set in the Messiah and also set by Bernstein and Chichester Psalms in Hebrew.
How timely.
It really, yeah, I mean, it couldn't be more so, right? But this is the work that we will premiere, give the New York premiere of as well. The Indianapolis Children's Chorus will take the stage for a portion of their on their own. And I will also conduct the Mimesis Ensemble in an orchestra work that maybe we'll dangle that as kind of the special lanyap for the audience to come and enjoy. But it'll be a beautiful and full program of music that can, I think, inspire all of us to and remind us all of what unites us is much more significant than the trivial things that seem to divide us at times.
Sharon Gamble with Indianapolis Symphonic Choir Artistic Director Eric Stark. The choir is celebrating the start to its 80th season with a concert called Return to Carnegie Hall on Sunday, October 16th. Learn more about that concert and the whole season at indychoir.org.
You're listening to The Art of the Matter on WFYI 90.1 FM Public Radio. Vonnegut's World, a week-long festival to explore what made Vonnegut Vonnegut, starts on September 7th and leads up to the world premiere of the opera Happy Birthday, Wanda June, presented by the Indianapolis Opera. Travis DiNicola spoke with the composer, Richard Alden Clark, and with Kevin Patterson, general director of the opera, to find out more.
Kevin, Richard, welcome to Art of the Matter. Great to have you guys here.
Thank you.
It's great to be here, and you're still here.
I am still here, just for a little bit longer.
Well, we're happy that you're here.
I made sure I stayed around long enough to do this interview.
Oh, well, we're very appreciative of that.
Well, I've been excited about this. I mean, I'm a Vonnegut fan, as I know you guys are, and this is a really cool thing to have this world premiere here and on this work, you know, that a lot of people don't even know of Vonnegut's. And I know we're going to learn more about the work in just a minute here. But I want to start with you, Richard. And you've been working on this piece a long time.
It's consumed most of my life over the last decade plus, and where I had not written a note of it until 2014.
Wow. How did this all start? Because you actually – you knew Vonnegut and
– I was very dear friends with him the last 15 years of his life. I worked with him on a lot of projects. Mm-hmm. A very good friend. Visited him all the time. We were always discussing music and literature and art and you name it. And after all the collaborations we had done together, Breakfast of Champions, Mother Night, Ice Nine Ballads from Cat's Cradle, Soldier Story, and the rewriting of his Requiem – he finally asked me to be the one to turn Happy Birthday, Wanda June into a play, into an opera.
Because it was originally written as a play.
It was a play. It was mm-hmm. off-Broadway. And I told him my concerns with turning it into an opera, that there was just too much dialogue, there was too many words, mm-hmm. and a lot of it had to be cut. So you could actually create arias so a singer would have more than a line or two to sing. And he agreed to help transform the play into a libretto.
And he basically sort of gave you the direction, right, that you could cut words but not add words?
I couldn't change a thing. I could only cut.
Okay.
And most of it I had his permission right then and there to cut. Say, can mm-hmm. we remove this line? Can this character have several more lines to say by removing all these other comments or responses? And near the end of the process, he was like, anything you need to remove in Act 3, just remove it. Because we had to get to the new ending he wrote specifically for this opera.
Which no one knows yet.
It's
no one's heard, no one's read, no one's seen. So
the last this world literary premiere, contribution of Kurt Vonnegut, as far as we know.
So, okay, so you're working on this, and this is the last thing Vonnegut wrote, and he dies in 2007, and so then what happened then afterwards?
I pretty much bagged the project. Yeah. Every time I tried to write something, I couldn't. I mean, he was really a close, like a family member. I mean, like a father or a grandfather, more than just a mentor or a friend or a collaborator. I mean, I really thought of him as family, and it was just too painful to work on the project. I felt this is far too big for me. I write chamber music. I write mm-hmm. small things. And so every time I tried to do something with the opera, I'd wind up writing a new trio or a new quintet or a new song cycle or something. And finally, I took a sabbatical from Butler University where I teach. Mm-hmm. And you have to have a project to take a sabbatical. So my project was, you know, I'm finally going to do this opera. And I sat down January 1st, 2014 and began the long pursuit. And on Valentine's Day of 2016, it was completed.
That's awesome. And then, so, Kevin, how did you get then connected with all this? I mean, obviously it's an opera, and so that makes sense since you run the opera. But
right. So my connection where I come into it is when I came to Indianapolis Opera in January of 2015, mm-hmm. I was reunited with an old friend of mine named Dennis Long, who I worked with at Indiana University during my undergrad years. And he's now the facility manager or the production manager for the Schrott Center for the Arts.
Okay.
So he and I were sitting around having a beer, catching up on old times, and I was talking to him about the direction that I'd like to see Indianapolis Opera go.
And you've been doing some pretty innovative, creative things there.
I mean, we're
like
trying.
You know, the opera, the Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat
right.
and such.
And, yeah. And Mansfield Park, the American premiere of that. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, Dennis said, you know, I have someone that you should meet. Mm-hmm. I know he's working on an opera. I have no idea what it's about, but you two should meet. So I said, great. I'd always love to meet composers. And so we met in late February, early March of 2015. And the minute he said to me, I'm working on an opera by Kurt Vonnegut, and Vonnegut wrote the libretto.
You were like, yes.
I sat up and was
like,
you're a huge Vonnegut
fan.
Oh, I'm a huge Vonnegut fan. I, being a Warren Central grad, Earl Milhon, who I'll never forget, my English teacher, we read a lot of Vonnegut short stories. We read Slaughterhouse-Five. We read Breakfast of Champions. And I love the fact that Kurt Vonnegut is a major 20th century author, doesn't make grand statements in his works. He asks you a series of questions, mm-hmm. and they nag at you and nag at you. And they turn the sort of the Midwestern sensibilities that we all are grounded in upside down and asks us, do you really believe what you think you believe? Mm-hmm. And so when he told me about Wanda June, I went off and immediately bought a copy of the play. I went to Amazon and got a copy, read it in a weekend, and came back to him and said, I'm in. let's do this.
That's so cool. And it works out great because doing it now, it also ties into the Indiana Bicentennial. And so there's so many interesting connections.
Yes. Yeah, so, you know, it ties into the Bicentennial. It is the first world premiere for Indianapolis Opera. It's Richard's first work. It is, you know, Vonnegut's last statement.
I mean, this is where it should be performed.
Yes. And yeah. I think Richard said to me originally when we started talking about the piece and being committed to it, he said, you know, I don't even know that Kurt Vonnegut knew that there was an Indianapolis opera. I'm not sure. Mm-hmm. But he said to Richard that, you know, he hoped that when the opera was completed that it would receive its world premiere here in Indiana.
Oh, that's so cool.
Yeah, he wanted it right here in Indianapolis.
Wow, that's awesome.
He wanted it right here in his home.
So, wow. So tell me a bit about the storyline. What's the basic plot here behind Wanda June? Happy birthday, Wanda June.
Well, this mercenary soldier comes back after being lost for about 8 years. Mm-hmm. He's been on a safari, and he's just disappeared. And his wife at the time has basically planned that he's dead and gone, and she takes on two lovers, and she has a son, and they live on Central Park West there in Manhattan. Mm-hmm. And she's living her society life and trying to figure out which of these decent men may be her future husband. And he's back.
His sidekick
is Colonel Loose Leaf Harper, who was the pilot who dropped the bomb on Nagasaki. Hmm. Kurt always has a World War II connection. Mm-hmm. And all hell breaks loose. But the important thing about it is she, right in the very beginning of the opera, she sings, "This is a very simple-minded story about people who enjoy killing and those who don't." Hmm. And it's that struggle of what makes somebody masculine, what makes them a hero. He's a racist. He's a sexist. He's a misogynist. I don't know, in our current political scene might mm-hmm. remind you of somebody, a no. megalomaniac rich, you know. Mm-hmm. And he goes on to wreak havoc on these people's lives. And it really does pose the question, what is masculine? Why is this person a hero? Why is this murderer brags about killing thousands of animals, having killed more than 200 men? Hmm. And then we get commentaries. We have people who are already dead and gone come back and give us their view of life and what a war hero really is, or what life in heaven is, about all their misconceived ideas when they were alive. And it's typical Kurt Vonnegut lampooning everything we thought we believed in. And like Kevin said, asking why? Do you
pretty
really
big
think
questions,
this?
Pretty big themes. I mean, this sounds like a great material for an opera.
And oh, it is.
Timeless.
It's excellent. I mean, we're dealing with themes of American exceptionalism. We're dealing with themes of soldiers coming back from war. And Kurt, I think one of the themes that caught me when I read the play and then read the libretto was this idea of, you know, what happens when a country sends patriots mm-hmm. off to war and they come back and they're so fundamentally changed as human beings that they can't live in our society because they're constantly looking for a way to go back to war. You know, we spend a lot of time with the conflicts in Iraq and Afghanistan where we've sent our military, and we've been preoccupied with the idea of how do we take care of these soldiers when they come back home. And that's a subject of hot debate. It's a very noble pursuit that we have to take care of our veterans. But there's another class of soldier mm-hmm. who comes home, and they're kind of under the radar. They come home, they come back into our world, and they've been fundamentally transformed as human beings, to the point where they don't recognize the world they left. They only recognize that they've got to get back to the world that they became and that they lived in. And so you see these soldiers who come back from Iraq and more recently Afghanistan who can't wait to get back to the front because they don't know another life now. Our political system, our American way of life has changed them in a way, and that they've got to get back. And it's a very interesting theme and idea yeah. that Kurt, you know, puts out there, because he's like, well, what if these people who come back that you want to hold out as heroes, they don't think of themselves as heroes. They just want to get back to the front and kill more people.
Right.
What do you do with them?
So this is an obvious question, but I just want to be clear, because some people may be thinking Vonnegut opera, this is going to be sung in English, not in Italian.
It is. Right? It is sung in English. And it is, you know, to Richard's point, it's very much a comedy. It's yeah. a very dark comedy. It's political satire. It was a protest piece during the Vietnam War. Mm-hmm. It was meant
when
to be
he originally
a,
wrote
when
it.
When he originally
a play.
Wrote it, it premiered in off Broadway in 71. Richard,
yeah,
yeah. So we're deep in the Vietnam War at that point.
Starred a very famous actress, Marcia Mason,
who
went on to win the Academy Award for The Goodbye Girl.
Yeah,
and she played Penelope, and you know, and there's a link to this to Greek tragedy. You know,
sure.
And it sounds
my first thought.
The Odyssey,
it sounds very much like
when
you know, a modern
returns
telling
to
of the
Penelope,
Odyssey.
His wife, and here's this hero come home, and everything has changed.
Yeah,
Kurt always has these extra connections, and but you know, that's why I say the piece is timeless, because all the issues that he was writing about in the late '60s and put this play off Broadway in the early '70s are everything we're talking about now and dealing with now, and you know, even the whole sexism thing and the way he treats women, and we're still talking about women being paid less than men for the same job, you know, and this whole masculinity thing. I mean, how we celebrate war, how we celebrate sports and all of that, yet these people who have deeper sensibilities, who are sensitive, are thought of being feminine in a negative sense of the term, you know? And we really haven't evolved as much as we think we have.
Richard,
and Kurt loves to point that out.
Let me ask you this. For you, what was the hardest part about turning this work into an opera?
Well, you know, people have this vision of what grand opera is. It's not grand opera, but my whole vision of opera was growing up with Rossini, and Verdi and Puccini and contemporary opera, not even really touching what that really is. I'm writing chamber music. I'm writing string quartets. I'm writing trios. I'm writing little songs. And all of a sudden, I have this enormous theatrical piece in front of me with this, you know, world-renowned author, and it's a play. And so many opera composers who I really respected, like Seymour Barab and William Mayer, kept saying, you can't just take a play and turn it into an opera. Somebody has to create a libretto. If you just try to set all the words, first of all, you're going to wind up with a Wagnerian opera because it takes that
It'll
long.
It'll be six
to
hours
sing.
Long.
Sure.
Yeah. If I used all the text in there, this would have gone on forever. Yeah. You want a concise piece. You want to carry across the meaning. And it's all dialogue. There were no arias. And, you know, other really tremendous composers have tried to do operas, and they've been just lampooned for writing too much recitative, too much, you know, and as much as people love some classical opera, you know, in modern day you often hear criticism. I recorded a couple of Baroque operas, and all the reviews said, too much recitative, skip all the recitatives, do the arias, and you've got a glorious work. And I thought, how am I going to do this? It's all dialogue. And so to sit there with Kurt and beg to remove certain lines and start editing Kurt Vonnegut while he's sitting in front of you, I thought, any
no, that's
second,
not
he's
intimidating
gonna kill
at
me.
All.
Yeah, he's
no,
going to
no,
toss
no.
me out the door.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah,
so. Kevin, from your perspective, what has been the biggest challenge in producing this and making this happen, bringing it to the stage?
The biggest challenge has just been the process of discovery that you have to undertake when you produce a world premiere. We, you know, as Richard said, the score was finished Valentine's Day of 16.
Mm-hmm.
We started in the fall of 15 with our resident artist program, workshopping the first act, and really going through and working through the process of hearing the piece for the first time, seeing how it worked theatrically, feeding that process back to Richard. We brought in Eric Einhorn, the stage director, to do the piece. He came in the spring and did a workshop when we had the full opera finished. And so there's this organic give and take that, you know, is a much different way to work than a lot of the opera that opera companies do, because we open up, say, Barber Seville, which we'll do in November. And, I mean, that piece
is you kind of know what you're doing with it.
Yeah, the piece has been locked in stone for a couple hundred years. So you open it up and say, okay, here's what we got.
Yeah.
You know, the biggest decision you have to make in Barber Seville is whether your Rosine is a soprano or a mezzo.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, here there are so many more choices.
It's all new.
It's all new. It also makes it a lot of fun because you're producing live art and you're doing it in the moment, and it's been so collaborative to work with a team. The give and take.
Briefly, tell me about your cast.
So our cast, so it's a cast of nine. We've brought in folks from the Metropolitan Opera, Jake and Jill Gardner. Jake will be singing the role of Harold Ryan. Jill will be singing the role of Mildred. We have two pants roles in the opera. So Wanda June is a girl, so not a pants role, but a mezzo. But then the role of Paul is a pants role, and that will be sung by Kirsten
Gornstein.
And a
pants role, that's a woman playing
it's
a man.
Woman, yeah, it's a woman in, we'll call it a woman in drag. Yeah. We'll update it. But Kirsten Gornstein, who has been a resident artist at the Indianapolis Opera, is coming back to do that role. We have some great local singers. So one that I'm especially excited of is this local baritone that we have named Galen Bauer. And when there's this role in Wanda June, Siegfried von Königswald, and he's a Nazi, and he comes out and he does this monologue, and it just floors you. And the first time I heard it, my mind immediately went to Galen, this baritone who lives up on the north side of town and sang in crescendo for us the first year. And I called Galen and I'm like, I'm typecasting you, Galen. This is it. And he,
not a great typecast, but okay.
I sent him the music, and he dove into it, and
phenomenal.
And it's just phenomenal. I mean, it just, you know, just nails you to the wall. So
that one scene, I think, is worth the whole. It is. Just to see this Nazi come out and sing about life in heaven.
Yeah, it's a phenomenal cast. We're very lucky that we have the Indianapolis Chamber Orchestra that's going to be taking a very active role. It's been incredibly new for them because, you know, they usually get their orchestra parts 6 weeks before we go into production.
Sure.
Well, some of them are just getting their orchestra parts today, and we open in 4 weeks.
Wow.
I mean, you know, we're making changes and doing things. Richard wrote out a viola part for a little intermezzo between act two and three.
It's still a process.
He finished it this morning. It went to Jill Gardner at 9 a.m. this morning and to the violist.
That's awesome. Wow. Real quick, before we wrap things up, we can't go through all of this, but what's really exciting also leading up to the world premiere of Happy Birthday, Wanda June, is the Vonnegut's World. It's a week-long festival, Vonnegut Festival, that sort of explores Vonnegut in many different ways. You've got a lot of different panel discussions at the Arts Center, at Butler. There's a play reading. There's a showing of Slaughterhouse Five. You've got Butler University performing the music of Kurt Vonnegut, which is going to be awesome. A brunch of champions, a roundtable performance at Indy Reads Books, final dress rehearsal. A lot of stuff leading up to this. This is very exciting.
Yes, and we did that largely because we wanted to involve the community in a dialogue discussion about Kurt Vonnegut. Vonnegut impacted us not only through his writing, but through his visual arts, through his playwriting, now his first libretto, his family. You know, the Bazille Opera Center sits on the former home of Franklin Vonnegut at 4011 North Pennsylvania Street. So we really wanted to take a world view. And so we're really happy that our partners, the Vonnegut Memorial
Library and partners.
Indy Reads and Butler and the Film Fest and the Indianapolis Arts Center have all come on board to help us and also help themselves, because Vonnegut was involved in a lot of these groups when he was alive.
Right. Well, and so the entire schedule of all the events leading up to the world premiere, as well as information about the world premiere and tickets and all that, of course, at indieopera.org, that people can get that.
And we have a special site just for this world premiere. Folks that want to go and learn just about Happy Birthday, Wanda June, can go to happybirthdaywandajune.com.
Awesome.
And they'll get information about the show, the festival, everything right there.
Well, I hope I'm still in town to see it, because I really want to, but you never know. But gentlemen, I wish you the best, and thank you so much for coming into Art of the Matter today.
Travis, thank you very much for the time, and good luck. We hope you're still in town to see it, but good luck in all your pursuits, man.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Travis DiNicola with the Indianapolis Opera's General Director Kevin Patterson and composer Richard Alden Clark. The world premiere of the opera Happy Birthday, Wanda June takes place at the Schrott Center for the Arts from September 16th through the 18th. For more information and a complete schedule of the upcoming Vonnegut Festival, you can visit indieopera.org, indieopera.org. Hey, Travis.
Yes, Sharon.
People who like light are going to love this weekend, and they're especially going to love our calendar that we call
What'll We Do? Enlighten me, Sharon.
Enlighten you. Oh, you're so clever. The Enlighten Festival, the celebration of Indianapolis Foundation's 100th anniversary, is this Friday and Saturday night. More than 20 light artists painting with light, designing with light, allowing you to dance at a silent disco, and, as they say, many, many more.
What's up with that?
Or what's up with
how many watts are up with
that? That's clever. Also, don't forget Feast of Lanterns this Saturday night, and also Saturday night, help to break a world record. The goal is 1,500 sparklers in Tarkington Park. I'm just saying.
That sounds like you can just like show up and be part of breaking the world record?
Yes, so the record right now is 1,414 sparklers. Registration starts at 6:30 at Tarkington Park. There'll be food trucks. Registered participants are given a wristband to enter the lighting area on the park lawn. Recommended age for official participants is 9 years old and above, just
excellent.
For safety. So
excellent.
All sorts of cool things going on with light. But, of course, the granddaddy of them all is the Enlighten Festival.
Excellent. Also, Fringe Festival continues on this
weekend.
Check out indiefringe.org for that schedule. If you're thinking about next weekend, what you might want to consider doing, going to the IMA for their new Day of Flight program, celebrating Indiana wildlife with a day-long event with bird demonstrations, nature workshops, a plant sale, and more. It's on Saturday, October 22nd. You can learn about beekeeping, participate in nature photography. You can shop for new additions to your garden and watch butterflies and hawks and hummingbirds. There's a hummingbird banding starting at 8:30 in the morning, and a birds of prey demonstration at 9, and a native tree and pollinator plant sale and butterfly talk. Not that butterflies talk, but there'll be a talk about butterflies and a demonstration and all sorts of fun things. Beekeeping at 1, songbird banding, bands.
Those
songbirds
bands
can
must be teeny tiny, especially for the hummingbirds,
yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm. So this is all at the IMA on Saturday the 27th. Sounds like a great day.
Hey, I wanted to both warn and remind you, if you are downtown in Indianapolis this Saturday from noon to midnight, thousands of motorcycles of all types will be taking over the streets for Downtown Indy Inc.'s Motorcycles on Meridian. So if you're fascinated by those machines, you have only to go to downtown Indianapolis, and then you'll be
very
downtown
cool.
When all the light stuff is starting.
There you go.
There you go.
Hey, if you're thinking about planning a trip for Labor Day weekend, the Indiana State Museum has put together 12 great day trips for Labor Day weekend all around the state to visit different places that celebrates Indiana's past and present, including Angel Mounds, Cordon Capitol, Culbertson Mansion, Gene Stratter Porton, Historic New Harmony, Indiana State Museum, Lanner Mansion, Levi Coffin, Limberlost, T.C. Steele, Vincennes, and Whitewater Canal. They have put this up on their website at indianamuseum.org/explore. Lots of great ideas of things to do for Labor Day weekend.
And if you're thinking of doing that, get a copy of Andrea Neal's new book called Road Trip, which is a series of road trips across Indiana to celebrate the bicentennial. We'll have an interview coming up with her very soon.
Excellent idea.
And don't forget, you can learn more about local arts events at indiearts.org/guide. The Arts Council of Indianapolis's Indie Arts Guide. And we'll tell you about more enlightening things
enlightening
on next year's calendar. Next year?
Next year?
Next
week.
Week's
just next
calendar.
Weekend's calendar
that,
that we call
What Do We Do?
You're listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Indianapolis and central Indiana. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. If your arts organization has an event or activity of which you think we should be aware, please contact us at least 3 weeks in advance. You can write us at The Art of the Matter, care of WFYI, 1630 North Meridian Street, Indianapolis, Indiana, 46202, or you can email us at artofthematter@wfyi.org. You can also hear The Art of the Matter on wfyi.org.
Indianapolis is home to what we believe is the country's largest business and arts luncheon, and this year the event is celebrating a big anniversary. Sharon Gamble invited Arts Council of Indianapolis President and CEO Dave Lawrence in to tell us about his organization's role in the Start with Art luncheon, plus give us an update on an arts and economic vitality study.
30 years, I feel like I should get you the 30th anniversary gift for Start with Art. I don't remember what that is. Somebody
yeah, I was gonna
who's
ask.
Just had a 30th wedding anniversary will have to tell. It's not Ruby. Ruby is 40, but I'm sure it's something interesting.
Should be.
And you haven't been around for all of them, but remind me, this is an unusual event. It might even be unique.
It is. This is, it's the Arts Council's sole fundraiser. And we take that opportunity to make it into a big old family reunion for the arts and cultural community, the kickoff to the arts season. And what we've found out in the last few years is it's one of the largest in the country of the business and arts lunches. So we're really excited that it's time to do number 30 on September 2nd.
And once again, we're like the Avis city. Wasn't it Avis that tries harder? Because it's like, you know, so we're not the biggest city. We don't have the greatest number of geographic amenities. We don't have mountains. We don't have big lakes. But I think there's the silver lining of that is we do try harder.
Absolutely. And I think that, you know, when our keynote speakers come every year for this, they're just amazed that an event of this size happens and that there's so many art supporters in one room, and they're always blown away by the energy and excitement and everything that's going on here. We really do have it really good here in Indianapolis.
And it always cracks me up because in your invitation, and I know I'm sure you and your staff felt a little queasy when you first had to say this, but registration starts at 11. Program begins promptly at 11:30. It is so hard to get people to sit down because regardless of, you know, museums and a lot of performing arts companies do perform year-round. Nevertheless, there's that fresh blast of energy with the start of September and a new season, and people haven't seen their friends for a while. So, and their friends include not just the artists and the arts administrators, but, oh, this guy over here used to be on my board. I got to go say hi to him and so forth. Remind us, how many people typically attend Start With Art?
We're over 1,100 now. So this is, huge crowd. It's great networking.
Yeah.
And I'll let you in on a sort of an insider secret. We stumbled upon an opportunity probably 8 or 10 years ago to the hardest thing, you've hit on it, is to get everybody to be quiet and sit down so that we can start at 11:30 promptly. So we started finding really good music groups to come in and play from 11 to 11:30 and draw people into the ballroom. And hopefully that will get them to sit down and listen to the music. And this year's no different. We're bringing in Stacy Sandoval and Trio Compás. So there's going to be some great Latin jazz music playing to get everybody sort of their blood pumping and ready for a good program.
Getting that dance your way into the ballroom. And
that's
sit
exactly
down,
right.
Take your seats because you have a jam-packed program. I'm so intrigued by the biography of Jane Chu, who is our featured speaker this year. I mean, this is a well-educated woman to be talking about the arts. She's has a bachelor's in piano performance, another in music education, master's in music and piano pedagogy, a master's in business administration, so an MBA, and a PhD in philanthropic studies. And that last one, by the way, is from a local school, IU. So this is a lady with broad, broad background.
Yeah, she has an incredible story and a wide range of experience. And this is somebody, you will find her so very charming and personable and approachable, but this is somebody who has a broad and deep knowledge of the arts and a true love to see arts integration happen in communities large and small all across the country.
She's held the NAA for not very long, right?
No, it's just been 3 or 4 years, I believe, but she has made a remarkable sort of stamp in the work that she's done, and her Creativity Connects program is really reaching communities across the spectrum all over the country and bringing art to neighborhoods and communities, and I'm really encouraged by that.
And I was looking at the guidelines for that, and that includes some grants that require not-for-profit arts organizations and artists to work with for-profits, including community developed CDCs and neighborhood associations and for-profit companies to get the benefit of both kinds of thinking.
Right. You know, and it's something here in Indianapolis that we know the value of, and that's public-private partnership.
Sure.
And so this program is really trying to foster that a little bit further. And I think that that's a great thing. We already see the benefit of it here and all the great work. I mean, look at the Cultural Trail. Look at all the work that happened through the Cultural Development Commission all those years ago. I mean, Indianapolis gets it. So I think she's going to be really is going to help sort of just say, you know, we're on the right path and we're doing the right things and give us some encouragement to go even further.
You know, I looked up public-private partnership on Wikipedia the other day and there was a picture of Indianapolis.
Really?
I'm kidding. But there should be. You know,
I'm not surprised.
That's not a bad idea.
Right.
Maybe we should put that out
there.
We need
to.
I mean, we totally get it. And sometimes I think people who, if our listeners haven't maybe served on an arts board or volunteered for an arts organization or aren't artists or arts administrators themselves, they may not realize how much communication there is between and among the arts community and the for-profit community.
Right. There's just so much of it here. I mean, if you look at one thing that I think it makes it really visible is the work that the Arts Council and other groups have done with arts infusion activities with sports events that are happening here in town. You know, I think that that's a really easy way for people to see, hey, you know, we had the Super Bowl here, but look at all of the murals that came up around there. And here is the 100th running of the Indianapolis 500. And we had artists painting Welcome Race Fans banners that were all over the city. It brings different elements to and enhancements to events to really put a unique stamp on the events.
And you and your agency have worked so hard over the years to really get arts to have a seat at the table in our city. And I want to just ask your advice because people who attend Start With Art, you may have a city county councilor at your table, and if not, you'll have a chance to network with one in that half hour between registration and the start of the program. What sorts of things are representatives? What do they want to hear from people? I mean, are they open to hearing individual stories like I put my kid in a junior theater program and it changed her life? Or what are they? Tell us about that kind of communication.
You know, they need to hear those stories. I think that one of the other important aspects of Start With Art is it's a really important time for us to share really positive stories about the arts and to advocate for the importance of arts in our schools and our communities, in our neighborhoods. And that's something that city councilors and other elected officials want to hear. They want to hear stories about how the arts are important to their constituents and how they've changed lives and communities and neighborhoods and how they're improving education. So I always encourage folks, if you have that opportunity to share that personal story, how your kid got involved, how it changed their education or their lives, share those stories. That's one way that we can make sure that people understand the true value of the arts.
And you and the Arts Council are really good at aggregating numbers and giving statistics and raw dollar amounts, but it's individuals and those personal stories that also stick in people's memories.
Right. We can spout numbers and statistics, and we've got them all. But boy, when you hear, this really changed my daughter's life or gave my son an opportunity to begin his career, that's where I think people really begin to stop and take notice that, wow, there's something really special and important going on here, and we need to continue that support.
Speaking of how the arts can percolate through a community, I know we're in the cycle once again of arts and economic impact study. Tell us about that and what people who go out to arts events might be seeing in the near future.
Right. So every 5 years, the Arts Council participates in a national study that is conducted by our parent organization, Americans for the Arts, in conjunction with Georgia Tech, to look at the economic impact both nationally and also in local communities. So there are several hundred local communities that are participating in this study, and the Arts Council and Indianapolis are one of those cities. In 2010, it gave us a wonderful set of statistics, including the fact that every year, $384 million of economic impact and activity happens here in Indianapolis. That's just in Marion County, $384 million every single year. And we know that when the 2010 study was done, that was, we were just coming out of the recession.
That's right. That's right.
So we feel that the 2015 numbers that we're collecting all that data from right now will show a marked growth and a strengthening of the arts community, and that impact number will grow. So there, for your listeners that are going to arts events, there are opportunities to complete what we're calling audience intercept surveys. And this is, so tell us about your experience tonight. Did you pay to park your car? Did you pay for a babysitter? Did you pay for a cocktail or dinner before? Did you purchase a souvenir at intermission? All the things that are part of that evening. And those numbers will be aggregated into and help define that economic impact number. The arts organizations are working very hard, too, on a long-form survey about their finances and in the last few years. And all of that information is crunched together. And then next June, we'll be presenting and sharing back with the community that economic impact number.
What's so interesting about that to me is lots of times if you just kind of top of mind thinking, you think, oh, what do you spend on the arts? Well, you might remember what the cost of tickets was, but you don't necessarily think about how your night out or your afternoon out percolates through the entire economy. Yes, you paid a babysitter and that babysitter
right.
took her money and did something else. You bought a cup of coffee from the concession stand and that went through the economy as well. So it's a really sophisticated lens to look through.
Right. And it does give us both indirect and direct spending. So the direct spending is how much did you pay for that ticket? You know, the salaries that we're paying our lighting designers and costumers and actors and actresses and musicians. But then those indirect costs are everything else that comes into a patron's enjoyment of the evening. And those are important ways and important things to capture when we're trying to look at the true economic impact of the arts in Indianapolis.
Sharon Gamble with Dave Lawrence, President and CEO of the Arts Council of Indianapolis. The Start with Art Luncheon is Friday, September 2nd. You can learn more at indiearts.org. Thanks for joining us today. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Bocelli Wallrap Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
Please listen to The Art of the Matter next week, Thursday at 8 p.m. and Saturday at 7 a.m., when I'll find out about scavenging the IMA grounds with Ellen Zakos.
Sounds fun. Then I'll chat with artist Don Gummer about his work.
And I'll get a preview of this year's Indie Jazz Fest, and we'll have that arts calendar we call
What'll We Do? So please listen next weekend to The Art of the Matter here on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio.
You've been listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in central Indiana and Indianapolis. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. Today's show was edited by Melissa Davis and produced by Travis DiNicola. The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you.